Well, I can't wait to start today. It's December 6th, 2022. Little children, and it's 16:04 and now 05 hours. 16:05 hours. And my name is Ward Green, and today's study is Psalm 66, of course, keeping the last numeral in line with the date. We also did some very, very exciting study yesterday with the chronology, or about the chronology, you know, securing our chronology based on the Bible and based on the facts in evidence, so that we have now, as I wrote in the article, B, which is also called preservation, that article, I believe that's this one here. In paragraph 9-9, I wrote something, but yes, it's B. There it is. So if I search for the name Jephthah, and in paragraph 9-9, I find his name. That's one of the places his name occurs in this article. And I make a statement in that paragraph that the entire period from BCE 1493 down to BCE 587 is secure. So that means that we don't have any doubts about any of the dates between those two time period years, those 2 years in BCE dates. In the time period BCE, those 2 years are secure, and everything in between them is secure. That's what that says. So the first one, 1493, was the year of the Exodus, when Thutmose I of Egypt, the Pharaoh of Egypt, died. And after that, we know all the other things happened before the destruction of Jerusalem in BCE 587. By the way, yeah, the destruction of Jerusalem was in 587 BCE, according to everything that we know. All the evidence, including the evidence of the Babylonian kings, also, who are known in great detail from the cuneiform tablets that were discovered in Babylon. I mean, since after these tablets were discovered, having been dug up from the ground in the area of Babylon, long after these events happened, of course. But these tablets show how many years each king ruled between the time of 604, which was year one of Nebuchadnezzar, all the way down to 539, which was when Cyrus conquered Babylon. And there are no missing years in that time period, so we know that 587 is correct for the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's from the Bible, as it's given as year 19 of Nebuchadnezzar II, who was ruling from 604. And he ruled for 42 years from 604 down to 562 BCE. But 562 was the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And then there were relatively few kings after him down to 539. When Cyrus conquered Babylon, and the kings that were ruling in during that time period are all documented with very many records of, you know, I mean, different kinds of records too. There are astronomical tablets, but there are also business documents that show that such and such transactions occurred in the year such and such of a certain king, and every king is given with regard to every year of his reign multiple times. So there's no doubt about how many kings ruled during that time period. What their names were is not in doubt. How many years they ruled is not in doubt. All those years from 604 to 539 are all known. And those records that were dug up in Babylon all agree, completely agree, with the known king lists that we have from Ptolemy, the Uruk king list, or the other. There's at least three. And if we look at, is it this article here? Let me just see. Well, that's a crucible. Okay. What's this article? Let's see. Maybe we have one of them open here. Moses. That's Moses. Is it? No, that's before. That's, there it is. Okay. Yeah, here it is. Here, History of Babylon, right in this chapter in the before chronology article called History of Babylon. Also, it's got a few names, but the article's called History of Babylon, among other names. It's called Before Chronology. But it is, if we look at the top here, it's called, if we look at the address bar, it's also called History of Babylon. That's sort of the file name. Yeah, so History of Babylon. But it's Before Chronology. But if we look at chapter 3 of that article, we see these other sources for the kings who ruled during the time period. It's called, there's one, that's the Egyptian chronology. There we have the Egyptian chronology given during a certain time period, which is the same time period that we're talking about, from 604 down through 539 is included within the time period of these pharaohs. And 610 is Necho II. These are not in doubt. From 664 and after, these are exact dates for these kings. These are not in doubt. Whereas if we go back prior to this, of course, even in 691, in 692 or 691, the day exact chronology of Egypt began, so that from 692 BCE on down through these years, every year of every king is exact. We don't have doubt about those things. There's no doubt of those things or concerning those things. So these are known. So therefore, it was, and we know it was during the reign of Necho that Josiah, the king of Israel, was killed. The king of Judah, actually, but he was the king of Israel in Jerusalem, or the king of Judah, as it was then called, because Israel had become a divided nation prior to that. But Josiah was killed. He was the king of Judah, and he was killed by Necho, so it had to happen after 610. So therefore, we can't go prior to that for any of that accounting of the death of Josiah. But we also know, coming down here, here's some other things. Here we have the kings of Babylon from Berosus. Berosus gives us a source, and he was a source from, was he not a Babylonian? Who was Berosus? Let's look him up. Berosus. Berosus. I have a feeling he might be spelled differently. Okay, he's spelled with two S's. Yes, he was Babylonian, wasn't he? He was Babylonian. See, his name starts with B-E-R, which is also derived from B-E-L, because L and R are the same letter, depending on the language. If you translate between languages, L can become R, or R becomes L sometimes. So Berosus means his name starts with B-E-R. Or B-E-L. And Bel is, of course, a god of Babylon. Bel was a Babylonian god. So therefore, the name Berosus is a Babylonian name, logically. And he was, himself, known as a Hellenistic-era Babylonian writer. Hellenistic apparently means sometime around the 3rd century, as it was explained about Berosus being active at the beginning of the 3rd century BCE, or BC. So, coming back to our article here about before chronology, we have the kings of Babylon according to Berosus, and we even have the predecessor of Nebuchadnezzar, who was Nabopolassar. We even know from Berosus the number of years that he ruled, 21 years. But we know that Nebuchadnezzar ruled for, I said 42, but 43 years, okay. That's obviously more correct than 42, according to Berosus, anyway. So 43 years for Nebuchadnezzar, and we have Evil-Merodach, or as it's spelled there, Evil-Marduk, 2 years, and then we have Nergal-Glissar for 4 years, and Labashi-Marduk for 9 months, and Nabonidus for 17 years. There were not a lot of kings after Nebuchadnezzar, and at the end of the reign of Nabonidus, Cyrus captured Babylon. So, little children, we have some way of learning these things, one source being Berosus. Now, if we look at another source also mentioned in this chapter, perchance there is a mention of another source. It's not by chance, of course, but we would not consider this by chance because I wrote this article and I know it wasn't. It didn't happen by chance because I had to write it. But Table 6, the Uruk King List, Uruk King List, we have also Nabopolassar 21 years and Nebuchadnezzar 43 years, Evil-Merodach 2 years, Nergal-Glissar. Instead of 4 years, we have 3 years and 8 months, and instead of 9 months for Labashi-Marduk, we have 3 months, but Nabonidus is also 17. So they're very much close. Those numbers are compared to Berosus, 4 years and 9 months for those two kings. That's the only difference between the two lists of Berosus and the Uruk King List, which are 3 years and 8 months instead of 4 years, and 3 months instead of 9 months. So there's not a big difference. But also there's some information missing here. This might say 1 year and 3 months. We got there's an ellipsis here because something is missing. So it's probably 1 year, 3 months, or possibly anyway. If it were, then that would account for the fact this is 3 years and 8 months instead of 4 years. This would make up the difference. 9 months, that would be 1 year and 3 months would be 6 months longer than 9 months, which would make up more than the 4 months necessary to account for the difference between 3 years and 8 months and 4 years for Nergal-Glissar. So there we have an interesting apparent close correspondence between Berosus and the Uruk King List. And also, we also have some more information, possibly, do we? Where is it from? Where do we have it? Let's take a look and see if there's any other source. Well, we had the Egyptian kings. We've got Ptolemy. That's the other thing. We have Ptolemy. So let's look for Ptolemy here. Let's see what we got. Let's look up Ptolemy. Ptolemy's canon, right? Well, here I say that during this period of 625, which is even prior to 604, and down to 538, which is just around the conquest of Babylon by Cyrus in 539, that period, which spans the whole time period about which we're speaking, is called the Neo-Babylonian period. And it's a period of 87 years, but be that as it may, Berosus and Ptolemy's canon agree exactly on the names of the kings and their terms of office, except for the king who ruled only 9 months. Neither Berosus nor the royal canon are needed nowadays because we have a large number of texts that has established by means of business records, legal documents, administrative documents, and chronicles, royal inscriptions, all of those, the same time period of each of the kings, according to what was dug up in the ground, the archaeology. So we nowadays can establish these things without even needing Berosus nor Ptolemy. But so that's a very important point. But now let's look up Ptolemy. This is really the holy grail of biblical chronology, right? Or biblical archaeology is the chronology of the time, the accurate accurate chronology of world history is the Holy Grail. In my own words, these are my words. I'm the one who said that. Now, and then ever since I said that, a lot of people have, seemingly a lot of people have picked up on this illustration of the Holy Grail and are using it over and over again for all sorts of other things that they weren't using it for before, but they're using it for now many times more than they were before. So I'm sorry if the video is blocking out some of the words here. Let me try to fix that problem partially so that we can just about like that. Pretty good. Okay. That should help, I think, a little bit. At least a little bit, if not more. But, I can also drag this whole window to the side so we can read the thing. But that won't work. Hang on. No. Okay. Yes, I can, but I have to shape it. Okay, so I'll do it this way. We can resize it so that we can read it at the same time as we're seeing it. So, right. So, we looked up Ptolemy. Or the royal canon, as it's called, more correctly. So in the article, my article, Before Chronology, these matters are discussed in quite a bit of detail. Okay, what's that? What's happening there? That illustration is missing. What is this? Is this the full article? This is the full article. Yeah, this is the full article. So it's now divided into parts. This article is divided into perhaps three parts. I'm not exactly sure how many parts. But if the article that you're reading is not divided into parts, then that's the old article. So the illustrations are not up to date in the old version, because there my website, my new provider, didn't allow certain characters to appear in the illustrations, and that's why they don't show up. So I had to modify the illustration names. I had to modify the reference to the names of the illustrations, so that they didn't have those characters in the names, so that they would appear. And consequently, the old version still I did not update, so I'll be able to tell that it's the old version because it's missing some illustrations. But anyway, let's continue. We can use this version of the article. The text is identical. So 1:8a. Here we go. We were reading chapter 1:8a, and then I got lost when it lost our place when I resized the window. So now, tens of thousands of dated texts have been unearthed, right? And the thing is, you know, there are people who perhaps believe a different chronology than what I'm presenting here. But on the other hand, you know, we can only help people as much as they're willing to be helped. And if they are not willing to learn the facts which we endeavor to teach them, then that's their own choice. You know, they have free will to decide what they're going to learn and what they're not going to learn. So we don't need to let it worry us at all if somebody else believes a different chronology. It's unfortunate, though, because when we have what we believe is the correct chronology, we want to share it with people. We want people to know the correct, true chronology. because it's the basis for all of truth. If we have chronology correct, then we have history, and if we have history, then it's really what happened. It's an accurate version of what happened. Without the chronology, it's really more of a mythology. And without evidence, such as I present in my articles, it's not as strong a basis for history. It's not as truthful, therefore it's not as real, and it doesn't provide that assurance or security, as I call it, for the dating. It doesn't make it real. It doesn't make it of actual history. It's not real unless it has accurate dates, actual dates, you know, that are real. Because, I mean, this is the basis for timing. The dating of things is the basis for what we call, you know, reality in the modern day. I mean, with, you know, the record of things, the chronology, the events, the sequence of events cannot be established without chronology. We can't establish what happened, and therefore we have no reality, right? So chronology is very important from that standpoint. It's not everything. It's just very important in order to establish what really happened, is to know the sequence, and to know the dating is to know the sequence. So I was looking up Ptolemy. The next reference is in 111. And there are a lot of things in this article which we can study on some other occasion, perhaps, too. But Ptolemy agrees with Berossus. And we know Berossus agreed quite closely with the Uruk king list. So here I mentioned the Uruk king list, the royal canon of Ptolemy. And I mentioned Berossus in this paragraph, which is 310a. So there are three sources there, independent sources, as far as we know, too. They're not dependent on each other. They didn't use each other. As far as we know, they were independent, and they came up with the same list of kings. And that's in addition to all the documents that were found, which we mentioned here. If we look up tens of thousands right here. Yeah. Well, there are hundreds of thousands of cuneiform texts in evidence since the mid-1800s of our common era. We've been digging these up since 1800 of our common era, 1800 CE, or 1800 AD, some people call it. But CE is the common era in which we live. We're in the year 2022 of the common era right now, and this is the 1800s. Since that time, there have been hundreds of thousands of cuneiform texts which have been dug out of the ground in Mesopotamia, tens of thousands of which are dated in the Neo-Babylonian era. Tens of thousands of them. Imagine that. And in one season, 6,000 from both the combined, that is the combined Neo-Babylonian and Achaemenid periods were discovered. 6,000 in one season. And all of these texts, without fail, give the same year allocations for the kings as Ptolemy in the royal canon gave, and as the Uruk king list, and as Berossus, with whatever minor differences those lists might have, very minor. So we know that we have precise chronology in this time period, and therefore we know when Jerusalem was destroyed, which is 587 BCE. It's secure. It's a secure date. But the one point I wanted to add is that there was the exile in 597, 10 years earlier. In 597, Nebuchadnezzar took a fairly large number of Israelites into captivity. And that's why in the book of Ezekiel, when we read that book, we see at the very beginning of that book of Ezekiel, which we will hopefully get to soon in our study, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, and then Ezekiel. Chapter 1, he mentions the 30th year here. And then the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, right, the heavens were opened up. Then he says in the fifth year of the exile, in verse 2, the fifth day of the month, that is, in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. And that's, he was the king at the time of the exile in 597. Whereas at the destruction of Jerusalem, Zedekiah was the king in 587, when Jerusalem was destroyed. On the fifth day of the month, in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. So that would be the fifth year after 597, so that's probably 593 or 592, one or the other. It's either 593 or 592 BCE when this was written by Ezekiel. However, there's also some discussion about what the 30th year means too. Well, we don't need to go into that right now. But I think, I mean, if I go into that right now, we just open up a lot larger discussion of all the other elements of this chronology, which it would be perfectly acceptable to do it, but I don't want to do it because I can't stop talking about it if I introduce that other element. So, but it's very clear the fifth year of the exile, which was we know was 597 because Jehoiakim ruled in 597, and then Jerusalem was destroyed in the 11th year of Zedekiah, and that was 10 years later, which is in 587, the 11th year of Zedekiah. So we know this is 597 for the exile. The fifth year of the exile, of course, was 5 years later, or four years or 5 years later. But the exile was 597, and there was another possibly very minor exile talked about in the book of Daniel, which is the book after Ezekiel in chapter 1. He mentions in the third year of the kingship of Jehoiakim, who was the father of Jehoiakim, and who ruled for also 11 years, similar to the number that Zedekiah ruled, very exactly the same, or, you know, it's numerically the same number, 11. Jehoiakim ruled for 11 years, and he began rule in 608 BCE. Or is it possible it was any later than 608? I'm trying to think. But wait a minute, I've got something. What's that mean in French? No, they're trying to tempt me. It's some kind of spam. So I will just say preference. You can't respond to people when you don't know what they're saying or who they are. You know, I'd rather lose money than be scammed too. You know, so I mean, it's just not. Well, look at the address where it's from too. It's from Nicolet6Orome@outlook.France something. It's a scammer. It's not from any company that I know or anything. So it's a scammer. So I just say, delete message in the future from that address. Click OK. And then apply the changes so that he's deleted from my inbox. And that's it. That's the end of that message. Okay. So in the book of Daniel, chapter 1, it says Nebuchadnezzar came to Babylon in the year 1 of Jehoiakim, who ruled for 11 years. And therefore, the end of his reign, Jehoiakim, his son, only reigned for a few months after him. So that exile in 597 was 11 years after Jehoiakim began to rule for 11 years. His son then ruled for a few months, and he was captured and taken into exile in 597. But in 608, 11 years earlier than 597, that's when Jehoiakim began to rule. And he, well, I mean, the precision of it is not what we're discussing here, how precise it was. It's the fact that it was 608. It is the number that we have, you know, arrived at, and it's as accurate as we can make it. And so that's his year one. The third year, therefore, is about 606, and that would be when Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and laid siege to it. And he didn't destroy it at that time, but he did take some captives. And in part of the utensils of the house of God in verse 2, he took. And he brought them to the land of Shinar. That's Babylon, apparently, right? Where he was ruling in Shinar. And he also brought these things, right? What, who else did he? But in verse 3, he brought some of the sons of Israel as well, right? Maybe just a few. It doesn't say how many he brought, but Daniel was one of the ones he took captive, right? And we don't know of any more other than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in verse 7 were the names given to Daniel's compatriots who were taken with him. So there were only four that we know of who were taken. But it says they were among the others who were taken. So there were more who were taken than just the four. But this happened in the third year of Jehoiakim. So this is long before the exile of... It's long before 597, unless we interpret the third year of Jehoiakim as being some other year than 608. You know, if it were five, I'm aware of what the Watchtower Society has said about this. They've said that the third year of Jehoiakim was the third year in which he began to serve Nebuchadnezzar, and he served him for 3 years. And so in the third year of his serving Nebuchadnezzar, that would have been 597. So this could be referring to, and if that's the interpretation, then this could refer, obviously also could refer to 597 being the third year. It could refer to the main exile, the major exile from Jerusalem in 597. That's what this could refer to. If the third year refers to the third and the final year of Jehoiakim, which was the third year of his service, according to one interpretation. But that's not right because, well, I mean, it doesn't say we have to know when he began to rule. The third year. So it's possible that there's another interpretation here of this, but if we were to interpret it that way, then there would be no exile at this earlier time, 606. So it's either, it could be 597 or 606. But it's not direct. It's not literally saying 590. It's not implying that in this particular chapter of this book, in this scripture, it's not implying the last year of the king of Judah called Jehoiakim. It's saying the third year, not the last year. So it doesn't imply that it's the third year of some other part of his. You know, the third year starting in his year 8 or year 9, it's not implying that at all. It doesn't indicate that at all. Where are the other cases? When did Jehoiakim? Let's look up Jehoiakim. I want to remember what was said here, but I haven't studied this. None of these things have I prepared. I've studied them at earlier times, all of these things. If we look up Jehoiakim, let's see. I need to get this bigger. There it is. Yeah, here it is. Yeah, that's right. They refer to 2 Kings 24, which is a possible interpretation of this. That Nebuchadnezzar came up and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. And then he rebelled. So if that's what this book of Daniel is referring to, the third year of Jehoiakim beginning his last 3 years, or sorry, beginning 3 years prior, or two years prior, whenever, so that his last year was his third year. In other words, if we look at the book of Daniel, where it says, in the third year of the kingship of Jehoiakim, which doesn't really ring true because he ruled for 11 years. But this would, in harmony with 2 Kings 24:1, well, that's another one, right? And carried off in exile. Right, okay. Where was the other one? He became his servant for 3 years. There it is. Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. Yeah. What was I looking at just now that I saw a different scripture? I clicked on something. I was clicking on Jeremiah 24:1. Okay, right. But 2 Kings 24:1, Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years, and then he turned back, right, and rebelled. And that was when after he rebelled, it's implied here that, well, Jehovah began to send marauder bands of Chaldeans. It doesn't really say that Nebuchadnezzar came up immediately after he rebelled. So it's not clear that these 3 years that are referred to here are the same as in Daniel in the third year of the kingship. The exile began, right? Or the siege began when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. But in any event, it's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem anyway. It's talking about the exile, right? One of the exiles. And there always were, even at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, there was another exile that followed that as well. There were different times of exile that are mentioned in Jeremiah. In the last book of Jeremiah, for example, you'll see that in the last chapter of Jeremiah. You can read it there, talking about the different exiles. But so there was more than one exile, but there was only one destruction of Jerusalem in that time period, and that was 587 BCE, as we've already mentioned thoroughly, and we've discussed it thoroughly, you know. But and we can discuss it more because it's very enjoyable to discuss the true chronology of the time period, of any time period, including that time period. It's not, you know, a hard, you know, it's not an unpleasant thing to discuss the true chronology, but knowing that as we do that Jerusalem was destroyed in 587, we still have to figure out a little bit more about when the exiles occurred, both prior to that and after that. And there was an exile in 597. This one, though, if it's literally the third year of the kingship of Jehoiakim and not the third year of his service to Nebuchadnezzar, which it also could be, but if it's not the third year of his service to Nebuchadnezzar, it's literally saying it's the third year of his kingship, which is also very plausible because Nebuchadnezzar began to rule as king in 605 BCE. His first official rule was 604 BCE, but 606 is plausible for the year that because at that time Nebuchadnezzar was the king of the, he wasn't the king, he was the leader, I should say, of the army. He was the king of the army. He was the leader of the army at that time. So he was the king of Babylon in 604 officially, but in 606 he was leading the army of Babylon, so he could have come up in that year, and we've discussed that in other articles as well. We discussed that, I discussed that at great length. Which article was that in? I discussed Nebuchadnezzar, was it in the Before Chronology article? Let's look up Daniel here. There it is. Yeah, it was in the Before Chronology article. This is part one of Before Chronology, if you're looking at the correct, the up-to-date version, which is divided into parts. This is part one. Chapter one is in part one. And it says all these points are brought out with regard to the exile of 597. And Jehoiakim ruled for 11 years. That's all discussed here, which will help you to understand better what I'm talking about here. But all the details of why or how this could have occurred are talked about here. As far as I know, up to the time I wrote this, as far as I knew at that time. So that's in chapter 1. And there's the Battle of Carchemish, which is mentioned in 605. And that was in Jehoiakim's year 3. Perhaps, it says here. But the Royal Record of Babylon talks about certain things. When I mention the royal record there, I'm talking about the Babylonian royal record mentioned in the previous paragraph. So now I hope I don't find any typographical errors right now, because then I'd have to go and correct it, and I hope I don't find any, because that's a real, it breaks my routine pretty badly. I've been working today, by the way, on my work carpentry, my carpentry on my ash tree that I felled in 2016, that I made into lumber in big slabs. I'm now processing the first top portion, the top slab, which is the worst probably of all the slabs, would be the top portion, because it's round on one side. But I'm processing it and into lumber, and so I'm pretty tired right now, because I processed the first piece and it was 55 inches long. That was how long I was able to get a piece of about 2x3 or something sizable, and you know, the second piece is a little bit heftier in thickness or width or both, and it's also a little longer too. It's longer, but it needs some glue to seal the cracks, and it's not done because I can't finish sizing it until I get the cracks glued. So it's the worst possible part of the lumber that I'm potentially going to get from this tree. And I'm just processing it today, so I was working with my power planer and my my circular saw, my jointer, my reciprocating saw, and my bandsaw to process this lumber. You know, all those things were needed to help me, and my chisels, you know, to try and help split. I had to cut to split the wood, though, from both sides. Once I cut both sides with the circular saw, I had a lot of work to do down in the basement today, and I was, you know, having a wonderful, you know, it was enjoyable. I was having a pleasurable time working on it. But it is pretty hard work. It was and it is, and I would like to do some more work on that, but I don't know if I'll be able to get to that today, because it's such hard work, and I need to get my other work done here, my video work done. And by the time that's done, I might be even more tired than what I think I am now. But I'm refueling with my vitamin K2 and my matcha tea lattes, which are very, very health-giving. The reason I think I'm feeling stronger and more energetic is I really think it has to do with the food that I'm eating right now, with all of the things that I'm doing nutritionally. I think that they have a very key element to play in all of my health that I'm experiencing right now. And the interesting thing is, I thought of an illustration the other day, just yesterday, I thought of something. Let's say you find a key. You find the key to something, right? It's a great discovery because you found the key. But then you say, there's only one question now. What is the key going to open? To what is the key? What is it the key to? What does it open? What does the key open? If you've got the key to something, but you don't know what it opens, you don't really have something, do you? Unless you know what the key opens. So having the key to health, understanding what the key is to health and longevity, long life, you know, having the key to strength, vitality, long life is a good thing, you would think. But you still have to know what the key opens. In other words, what is the key? What is it the key? To what is it the key? To what is it the key? Like, you have to know what that is first before you can use the key. So it's not enough to find the key, right? Like, you could say, well, I found the key to the chronology of the world, which is good. It sounds good. It should be good. It's the Holy Grail, perhaps, to the Bible. It's the Holy Grail of biblical archaeology, as I've described chronology. But also, you know, it's needed. The key is needed in order to unlock chronology, right? You need the key somehow you need to find the key somehow to be able to unlock what the true chronology is, but you have to know what is it unlocking, and you have to know to what is it the key, like to what specific thing is it the key. You can't just have the key and not have the object or not have the thing that the key opens. You need the other thing too. You need the thing that the key opens. And that's the illustration that I'm going to be talking about maybe more in the future. I don't know. But it's an illustration that occurred to me that was very important in the example of health. If you find the key to good health, but you don't know what good health is, then the key is not going to do you a lot of good. You have to be able to find good health before you can find the key to good health. You have to be able to find it. It's not as easy as it sounds. That's for sure. Finding good health and finding the key to good health, those are not easy things to achieve. Not at all. That's why it's taken me the better part of my life, maybe. Or maybe not, hopefully not the better part of my life. Hopefully I'll live longer than that. But there's a detailed discussion here about these dates that we've been just talking about, with the exile in 597. 10 years, that is, 10 years prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. And there are also astronomical records from year 37 of Nebuchadnezzar, which we discussed yesterday as well, little children, that helped us see that 604 BCE is year one of Nebuchadnezzar. But nobody presents any better evidence than what we have, that 604 is year one of Nebuchadnezzar. This is the best evidence, and we need evidence when we're establishing truth. We need evidence. In a court case, we need evidence. You can't just present things without evidence in a court case. You need evidence, right? And the Bible is a legal case, as it's called the law of Moses, for example. And the Bible is God's word, right? But it's a legal case. If we look up in the Bible, okay, I think we're done talking about the chronology for today. But let's look up the legal case idea, right? And see what happens. See what comes up. In the book of Hosea, chapter 4, look at this. Jehovah has a legal case with the inhabitants of the land. So Jehovah's interested in legality. He's interested in justice. And this is evidence for it right there. This is Isaiah, chapter 1 of Isaiah, talking about there's a problem because the legal case of a widow does not get justice, or even it doesn't even get into the courts. It doesn't even get there to be in the court. They're just not able to get justice because there are stubborn, corrupt people who are in charge. And as everyone has heard of and talked about, in our times, we typically see that that's the case, where the rich people are able to afford to have good lawyers. They can, like, we see that people can go to court. Like, we see how many times Donald Trump has gone to court because he can afford to go to court, and he can afford to hire the best lawyers, and he goes to court quite frequently because of that. Whereas the poor people don't actually get to even have their cases heard. And we know that that's typically the case. Even if it did get to court, we know that typically the poor people don't win the court case, not just because they can't afford a good lawyer, but because there's corruption in the system. And the judges don't tend to favor the poor people either. There's not equality, and there's not justice in the existing court systems, even in the West, even in the American system in the United States, for example, or even in, you know, in any part of, it's worse in the United States, I would imagine, than it is in Canada in that way, but it's not entirely dissimilar, I wouldn't think. There's a corruption existing, and there's a bias against the poor people. And that's something that is present even nowadays, and it was present back in the time of Isaiah, as he was mentioning, and he was, as for example, in the case of the widows, as he was discussing in Isaiah chapter 1. Look at even in Deuteronomy. Okay, that was about how legal matters were to be conducted according to the law of Moses. There's nothing unusual, terribly unusual about that. But the legal case over Zion was talked about in Isaiah 34, a day of vengeance of Jehovah, a year of retributions for the legal case over Zion. A year of retributions. That's hard to say, a year of retributions. A lot of R's in that, seems to me. A year of retributions for, there's another R, the legal case over Zion. So there's a legal case over Zion. Jehovah is conducting a legal case. The Bible is a legal case. Therefore, we need to have witnesses. We need to have evidence presented by witnesses, not just witnesses, but evidence. And that's why we've been talking about these pieces of evidence that establish the chronology. It can't be established in the same way without evidence. Therefore, evidence is far preferred, not just preferred, but far preferred in a court case. It's almost indispensable in a court case to have evidence. So, our study for today, little children, is, as we come to the last part of our study for today, or the last part of our discussion for today, hopefully we'll have time to do it, but this is not going to have to, we won't have to rush it, but this is a longer psalm. And I don't know how long the Isaiah, let's check to see how long the Isaiah chapter is for today, to see if it's long or not. 46. I really enjoy reading it without preparation, but at some time in the future, I'm fairly certain I will be preparing my studies of the chronology better, because it's so detailed. But I don't want to, if I prepared it, just imagine how many things I would mention. If I'm mentioning so many things without preparation, how, I'm just basing it on my memory of all this prior study I've done and prior writing of articles that I've done. If I'm basing all of what I'm talking about purely on memory, which I am, and I'm not attempting to prepare in advance, just imagine how much I'd be talking about if I'd prepared. So I'm not really wanting to do preparation, even just for that reason, that I would just be I would just be sharing that much more information, which would be that much more difficult to absorb for those of us who are less experienced in these matters of chronology and history and even the Bible too. So this is a short one in Isaiah. That's fortunate. That's very blessed. That's very wise on Jehovah's part to allow that to happen for us. Jehovah's causing this to happen for us in the way that he is, apparently. To the director, a song, a melody. Doesn't say who wrote it. Psalm 66. Jehovah God, our Father in heaven. The righteous Father. Our righteous Father who conducts a legal case over Zion. Please hear our prayer and help us to learn wisdom from your word, the Bible, in our study today. In Jesus' name. Amen. Isaiah 66. No, it's wrong. Psalm 66. Shout in triumph to God, all you people of the earth. Make melody to the glory of his name. Render his praise glorious. Say to God, how fear-inspiring your works are. Because of the abundance of your strength, your enemies will come cringing to you. All people of the earth will bow down to you, and they will make melody to you. They will make melody to your name, Selah. Come, you people, see the activities of God. His dealing with the sons of men is fear-inspiring. He has changed the sea into dry land. Through the river they went crossing over on foot. There we began to rejoice in him. He is ruling by his mightiness to time indefinite. Upon the nations his own eyes keep watch. As for those who are stubborn, let them not be exalted in themselves. Selah. Bless our God, O you peoples, and cause the voice of praise to him to be heard. He is setting our soul in life, and he has not allowed our foot to totter. For you have examined us, O God. You have refined us as when refining silver. You have brought us into a hunting net. You have put pressure on our hips. You have made mortal man to ride over our head. Look at that, made mortal man. That's hard to say. You have made mortal man to ride over our head. We have come through fire and through water, and you proceeded to bring us forth to relief. I shall come into your house with whole burnt offerings. I shall pay to you my vows that my lips have opened up to say, and that my mouth has spoken when I was in sore straits. Whole burnt offerings of fatlings I shall offer up to you. With the sacrificial smoke of rams, I shall render up a bull with he-goats. Selah. Come, listen, all you who fear God, and I will relate what he has done for my soul. To him I called with my mouth, and there was an extolling with my tongue. If I have regarded anything hurtful in my heart, Jehovah will not hear me. Truly God has heard. He has paid attention to the voice of my prayer. Blessed be God, who has not turned aside my prayer, nor his loving kindness from me. And that's the end of Psalm 66. Verse 18, if I have regarded anything hurtful in my heart, Jehovah will not hear me. Look at that. How many times have we cursed God because we were selfishly thinking of ourselves? and things weren't going well for us for some reason, and we blamed God. But it even says in verse 18 here of Psalm 66, God won't even hear that. Jehovah doesn't even hear that. But he hears our prayer in verse 19. Isn't that remarkable? It's remarkable. And then, I mean, that is remarkable to me. It really is. And we look at this. You have brought us into a hunting net. You've put pressure on our hips. That's what God does to us in the way that he refines us. He refines us in verse 10 and 11. He refines us. He allows us to be examined. Like on the witness stand in a court case, for example. You know, we're examined. We're refined in some way. We have to test our own wisdom and make sure that it's true. You know, we're refined by Jehovah. And those who are stubborn, let them not be exalted in themselves. In verse 7, that's good, a wise phrase or a wise sentence. We tend to be stubborn if we get an idea, we want to build something, or we have to be. If we want to build something and we want to get it done, we have to be stubborn about it. Or we might just go off and do something else. So there is some element of stubbornness. But let us not be exalted in ourselves. Right? Verse 7. What another wonderful piece of wisdom there. I mean, that I love that, because when we're stubborn, sometimes things don't go our way. And that prevents us being exalted. Because we see that Jehovah is not always with us if we're stubborn. He's not always going to go in the way we go, just because we think that things should be a certain way. It doesn't mean that Jehovah agrees with that, and he doesn't always agree with it. But look back further here. Well, besides the fact that his enemies will come cringing to him, another point, that is, you know, and all people of the earth will bow down to him, and they will make melody to him. That's pretty explicit and it's even surprising, perhaps, to read that. It might be unbelievable to us that all people will make melody to Jehovah. We know he changed the sea into dry land when the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. That's referred to in verse 6. And also through the river they crossed over. That was the Jordan River when they came to into the Promised Land in the year BCE 1452, as the genealogy dates it. He's ruling by his mightiness. It still has this other... Oh, I highlighted that. Okay, let's garbage that. There we go. That's how you get rid of that. Bless our God, O you peoples. We should be praising God. Praise Jehovah. Right? That's what this verse 8 talks about. He sets our soul in life. Well, that's a wonderful phrase. He sets our soul in life. I think little children might appreciate this. All of us little children might appreciate it, because we don't have life by any effort on our part. We got life from Jehovah himself, because our parents, even they, would not have been able to give us life if they had not been given the power to procreate by Jehovah, which they were given. So Jehovah sets our soul in life. And if we're not dead yet, then he's not allowed our foot to totter. In verse 9. And he refines us, as we discussed. Jim, I'm just reviewing it, but there was something I wanted to cover here. It was something I wanted to point out here that I'm looking for right now. Well, maybe that was, I mean, I've covered it all. I don't know what I was seeing before. Now, I thought there was something in there that I wanted to. Specify and highlight at the first reading. Anyway, I thought there was something in there. Let's see. What he's done for my soul. There's the James Taylor song. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. It's a James Taylor song. We've come through fire and through water. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. That relates to that James Taylor song. Upon the nations, his own eyes keep watch. Oh, I know what it was. It was this verse 7. He is ruling. Jehovah is ruling by his mightiness to time indefinite. So I just wanted to highlight that sometimes time indefinite means forever, right? Other times, if, like in the case of the law of Moses and the old covenant, the law of Moses was done away with, so time indefinite for that was indefinite in the sense that at the time it was written, it was unknown when the Messiah would be coming to abolish that covenant. So the Messiah did come and abolish it, but it was indefinite how long it would be lasting. Whereas at other times, Jehovah's ruling to time indefinite, for example, in that case, time indefinite means forever. Or it certainly means a totally different thing. It means, I mean, there's no one who's going to come and abolish Jehovah's kingship. He is ruling to time indefinite means forever in the case of Jehovah. So the words time indefinite really is indefinite in the sense that we're not sure how long it is, but it basically means forever or time indefinite, depending on the case. So let's carry on now with Isaiah. So I really enjoyed that part of the study, but it was fairly straightforward for the Psalms, but we don't know who the author of that Psalm was. Isaiah 43, Bel has bent down. Nebo is stooping over. Their idols have come to be for the wild beasts and for the domestic animals. Their loads, pieces of luggage, a burden for the tired animals. They must stoop over. They must each alike bend down. They are simply unable to furnish escape for the burden. But into captivity their own soul must go. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all you remaining ones of the house of Israel, you the ones conveyed by me from the belly, the ones carried from the womb, even to one's old age, I am the same one. And to one's gray-headedness, I myself shall keep bearing up. I myself shall certainly act, and I myself may carry, and that I myself may bear up and furnish escape. To whom will you people liken me, or make me equal, or compare me, that we may resemble each other? There are those who are lavishing out the gold from the purse, and with the scale beam they weigh out the silver. They hire a metal worker, and he makes it into a god. They prostrate themselves. Yes, they bow down. They carry it upon the shoulder. They bear it and deposit it in its place, that it may stand still from its standing place. It does not move away. One even cries out to it, but it does not answer. Out of one's distress, it does not save one. Remember this, that you people may muster up courage. Lay it to heart, you transgressors. Remember the first things of a long time ago, that I am the divine one, and there is no other God. nor anyone like me, the one telling from the beginning, the finale, and from long ago, the things that have not been done, the one saying, my own counsel will stand, and everything that is my delight I shall do. The one calling from the sun rising, a bird of prey, from a distant land, the man to execute my counsel. I have even spoken it. I shall also bring it in. I have formed it. I shall also do it. Listen to me, you the ones powerful at heart. You the ones far away from righteousness. I have brought near my righteousness. It is not far away. And my own salvation will not be late. And I will give in Zion salvation to Israel, my beauty. That was Isaiah 46, and that's the end of that chapter. So we are now up to an hour and 11 minutes. That is an interest. I don't need this. I was cold when I first put on my new jackets. I've been in my working jacket. When I put these colder jackets on, I was cold at first, but then I've now gotten far too warm and I need to cool off. And now I'm going to have to wash pretty soon too. I think I might be done for today because I want to work maybe again tomorrow. It rained outside today too, so it was a good day to do some work indoors in the workshop. I created a lot of dust, so I had both my dust filters running in the basement. So it should be, the dust should have died down a little bit now with the dust filters having been run for a while. So I could go and work again, but if I work more today, I'll just be too tired to work tomorrow. So I'm not sure if I will or not, but I'd like to work today some more because I've got more wood to cut. But it's a very creative process because I'm not going to build any idols with this. I'm doing construction of my wall and door to protect my garage area. That's what I'm doing. So it's pretty essential work. But all of my work, I suppose, is done in order so that I can help myself and others to get better health and to understand Jehovah better. I want to help people in that way. That's my ministry. So protecting my vehicle is equally important because it's part of my ministry. It makes my life easier because I can then have I can be spending less time clearing snow off my vehicle, for example. That's one thing. It can protect my whatever possessions I'm storing in that area underneath the carport. They can be protected. My possessions can be better protected by sheltering from the rain and snow. But it has to be designed properly because the wind can put forces on things. So if you build a wall, that could just enable the whole structure to be blown upon by the wind in a way that could damage the structure even worse than if you didn't have any wall. So putting a wall has to be considered carefully, and you have to allow the wind to pass through, perhaps more so than you might prefer, in order to ameliorate some of the force or reduce it. So Bel has bent down. Their idols have come to be for the wild beast and for the domestic animals. Their loads. They've come to be loads. In other words, these idols are carried around on the beasts of burden. It's very interesting, but Bel has bent down. Their idols must Oh, okay. The idols have come to be a burden for the tired animals, and these idols are unable to furnish escape from the burden. And then it says an interesting statement, into captivity, their own soul must go. So it's saying that these idols would not protect people from being taken captive, apparently. That's what it's saying here in Isaiah chapter 46. And then we read also that Jehovah had set our soul in life. In Psalm 66, we just read that Jehovah sets our soul in life. And then in Isaiah 46 and 3, the house of Jacob are the ones conveyed by Jehovah from the belly. In other words, he set their soul in life, is consistent entirely with this. They were carried from the womb. But so too is spiritual Israel carried from the womb today. Spiritual Israel and those who are born again by the Spirit, the born again Christians who are born from the womb, from water, but also from spirit, as Jesus said, you must be born again, when he was talking to Nicodemus. I think that was John 3 and 5, actually, if I'm remembering correctly. By the way, I booted my computer twice today before it booted correctly, so the second time it worked. The boot worked on the second try today. Jesus answered, most truly I say to you, unless anyone is born from water and spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. John 3 and 5. And Isaiah 46, even to one's old age, Jehovah says, I am the same one. So Jehovah doesn't change during our lives. He's a stable source of assistance for us, but he even sets our soul in life. So this is Ward Green. Is our time up? I think our time's up. It's very close to being time up here. But, you know, some people don't appreciate this privilege of serving the true God. Instead, they are using all their riches to build false gods out of gold and silver, it talks about here in verse 6. And they bow down to these false gods. And then they carry it upon the shoulder, or upon the wild beast, or whatever on their shoulder. So these idol gods are a burden for the tired animals, because they have to carry the idol gods to the place where they're going to install these statues of worship, right? And then, but these don't provide any protection from the enemy. They don't. These idol gods cannot prevent a whole nation from going into captivity. In verse 2, they just don't have power to protect anybody. They don't furnish any escape. In verse 2, for the burden, either. They just become a burden on the tired animals who are having to carry these heavy objects of worship. And then after they carry it on the shoulder, they bear it, they deposit it in its place so that people can worship it as a false god. And when you cry out to these false gods, they don't answer because they have no mouths or anything. They can't speak. They have no ability to speak. They have no power at all. And it doesn't save out of one's distress. Jehovah says, remember the first things. I am the divine one. There is no other God. That's what he says. These other idol gods, they're nothing. I am the true God, he says. Right? I am the only God. And he calls from a distant land, like Cyrus, whom he called to execute his counsel and free the Israelites from Babylon, a city where they had many idol gods, where they worshipped false gods of silver and gold. My own salvation will not be late. Where else have we seen that? It will not be late. Habakkuk 2 and 3. Isaiah 46 and 13. My own salvation will not be late. Habakkuk 2 and 3. The vision is yet for the appointed time. It will, without fail, come true. It will not be late. Thank you for listening. This is Ward Green. It is December 6th, 2022, 1725 hours, coming up to 1726 hours in a few seconds. Have a wonderful day. God bless you. I do love you. And all the best in all your endeavors. Praise Jehovah, and bye for now.